a little bit of the flavor of the theory that's underlying what the results are that Jamie came up with. So can you... So in some sense, I want you to... The sort of takeaway message I'm hoping to get to is you'll sort of see, you know, that it's not quite as miraculous as Jamie's talk maybe perhaps made it sound, but also a little bit about why
I try to explain the dance that magicians should never reveal. People find out it wasn't there.
So the other thing is that a little bit of the theory, a little bit of the technical theory here involves things that are that involve graphical models that perhaps aren't familiar to everybody here. And there's going to be a certain amount you'll have to just, if you haven't seen these before, you may have to just kind of take on trust. So let's go to where's document. Okay, let's put this over here. Okay. So I see. Is there some way to get these lights off? Because there seems to me to be no.
Over here somewhere.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Okay. So this is joint work with Ilya Spitzer, Jamie Robbins, and Stefan Lauritsen. So I've got this word pseudo-intervention. You'll see in a moment what that's talking about. So I'm going to first just give you a basic review of what causal discovery is, what the basic problem is. Jamie talked about it before, but I'm going to give you a graphical picture of what's going on. Then I'll talk briefly about these non-Markovian constraints that have a bit similar to conditional independence, but they're not conditional independence. Then I'll talk about pseudo-interventions, and then this is where it gets a little more technical, and I'm going to kind of just give you the big picture overview of this. And I've tried to finish in, before 12, but before 11:45, that's my plan. Okay, so if we have a graph like this, a DAG like this, then that implies certain conditional independence relations holding amongst the variables of that graph. In this particular case, x0 and x2 are conditionally independent given x1. So in graphical model terminology, we'd say a Markov property associates certain conditional independence relations with the graph. So causal discovery is the game where basically you come along and tell me conditional independence relations that are implied by some unknown graph, and then I have to then work out what is the graph that gave rise to it. And in order to do that, you have to assume that the independences, you have to make the assumption that the independences are due to the Markov property, due to the structure of the graph, and not due to things exactly cancelling out. That's known as a faithfulness assumption. So for a given pattern of conditional independence from the DAG, you can solve back for the DAGs which imply them. That was solved by the PC algorithm. There's also an earlier algorithm due to Verma and Pearl that solved that problem. I should make a point, sort of from a statistical point of view, these algorithms are consistent, but they're not uniformly consistent. And so you sort of need to be aware of that right from the beginning. This is a point that Jamie has made several times. So this was an easy game where I said to you, I've got a DAG. That DAG involves the variables that we observed. And now I'll tell you the conditional independences, and then you have to work out what is the graph that gave rise to it. And basically, one of the other points is that, like many inverse problems, there isn't a one-to-one relationship in general. So there are many graphs that are consistent with a particular pattern of conditional independence. So these have different causal interpretations, but they all have the same Markov property. Okay, but you might say, well, that's all very interesting, but who would believe that the observed distribution, if it's big enough of a stretch to believe it came from some DAG, assuming that we observed all the variables for that DAG seems like a pretty big assumption. So we relax that and say, okay, so now let's consider the problem. Now, just instead of considering all possible DAGs over the observed variables, now I'm going to allow arbitrary hidden variables. Okay, so the idea is, you know, this, there are more of them. But for example, if I have these two independences, then these are all DAGs over hidden with hidden variables that give rise to those particular conditional dependencies when we apply the Markov property. And you might say, well, it looks as if, doesn't it look as if absolutely anything could happen? And no, I mean, there is a lot of variety here, but there are certain things. So you'll notice that we never have a directed edge from x3 to x2 or x3 to x1. And that's not just because I haven't listed out enough examples. We could prove that that would be the case. It's the case that these all have a directed edge from x3 to x4, and that there's no confounding there. And again, that's not just because I'm not imaginative enough to come up with a graph that does that. That's a property. So that if we assume faithfulness, then in this inverse problem, we are getting real information out. We're getting out that x3 is the cause of x4, or there's a directed path from x3 to x4 in the underlying DAG, and there's no confounding of that.
If
you know deconnection, so if you know how to read independence off DAGs, then you can sort of see it. So suppose that there was a hidden confounder here. If there were a hidden confounder here, then there would be some hidden thing here pointing into x3. So x3 would be a collider on a path from, it would go x1 collider up to here, x2 collider up to here, which would then mean that x1 and x2 were not conditionally independent from x4 conditional on x3. Okay? But that's one of the things that we've got over here. So that's a sort of simple version, and that's the sort of simple. Okay, so yeah, so I mean, for example, here in this case, we don't have a collider. We don't have x0 and x2 pointing to x1. That's not there. Okay, so we haven't got all the possible tags there. Okay, so instead of just writing them all out like this, that gets tiresome pretty quickly. So we can come up with a representation that summarizes all the graphs in that collection. And the particular, this for example tells us that in no graph that we, in the equivalence class, is x3 an ancestor of x2, nor is x3 an ancestor of x1, and in every graph in the equivalence class, x3 is an ancestor of x4. And we can also tell there's no confounder between x3 and x4. So basically, in this particular setup, we've learned that there's an instrument. I mean, in some sense, we've also learned that there's no confounding here. And you've learned that x3 causes x4 from data. Yes. Yes. Except for faithfulness. So I should say this assumption that there is no cancellation. I mean, if you have determinism in your data, that's not going to hold typically. And that's one of the main situations where that will be valid. Anyway, so there's an algorithm that will go from conditional dependencies induced by some DAG with hidden variables back to a representation of the equivalence class of models with latent variables. And that's called the FCI algorithm. And yeah, so one of the things that we learn here, so I'm using Lauritsen's notation. So this is the distribution of X4. Given do x3. And so one of the things that we've learned here is that the intervention distribution on x4 when we intervene on x3 is just the same as the conditional distribution of x4 given that we condition on x3 in every graph in that class. So even though I don't know the whole structure, I know that I can, under this particular framework, I know that I can work out the effect of x3 on x4. Okay, so there's this algorithm that does this. It's implemented in a Tetrad program, download it from the web. But basically, Jamie had this sort of nagging feeling that we could do better, that basically we could get more information out of this. And so now I'm going to talk about that. So we can get more information. We can do. There are constraints that we're not exploiting. And these constraints have sort of been considered in a number of contexts. They've been called dormant independence, or a generalization of dormant independence in recent work by Spitzer and Pearl, and they sort of have floated around under the name Verma constraints for a long time. But I'll just give you a sense of them. So here's the graph that Jamie looked at. And so this was the one he recovered at the end of the talk, which is, so it's a bit complicated, the first step that Jamie did, so he went from the original data distribution to a star world. And the way that he got to the star world was by dividing by the conditional distribution of x1 given x0. Okay. And graphically, we can think about that this is just the cutting edges thing that Pearl talks about, that when we intervene on a variable and its parents, we just cut the edges. Okay? So that the new distribution that's generated by dividing by P of x1 given x0 can be just represented like this. So we just cut. There was an edge here. It's gone. Right? So we've got a new distribution. So I should add, going back here, there are no conditional independences holding amongst the observed variables in this graph. So that was one reason Jamie said, you know, you run the algorithm and it gives you no information back whatsoever. There's no conditional independences. We can check that if you want, but it's easy to see. Okay. So this was the first step. This graph now represents the star world distribution. And then the second step was to marginalize over x0. And that's sort of, that you can see in this graph, that doesn't have any observed children, it doesn't have any children at all, so we can sort of marginalize over it and we get to this graph. And then when we get to this graph, so remember, going back to his derivation, the first step was to divide by P of x1 given x0, and then the second step was to divide by P star of x3 given x2 and x1. So in the new distribution that was induced, we then did another division operation. And that other division operation corresponds to, in this graph, cutting these edges going into x3. We just chop those, and we get to this. Okay? And when we get to this graph, we can then stare at that graph, and we can say, oh, look, we've got x1 and x4 being marginally independent in that graph. Okay? So that's a constraint that we derived. So we've derived a constraint on the observed distribution that arose from the original graph. It's not a conditional independence constraint. It's a conditional independence constraint that arises after doing these two reweightings, these two divisions. Okay? So it also has an interpretation that the distribution of x4 when we intervene on x1 and x3 is not a function of x1. Okay, so that's fine. So this is going in the forward direction. So that's like the Markov property. So the Markov property I showed you in the beginning, we had this simple little graph, and then I told you how to get out a conditional independence from that. I just told you we could get out a conditional independence from that. So here, in this particular case, I've shown you a series of steps that let us get to the conclusion that x1 is independent of x4 after these two reweighting steps. Okay, so, but now for causal discovery, we want to do the opposite. So we want to go from the fact of a particular independence, or independence after reweighting, we want to go back to the possible DAGs that could have given rise to it. We have to do that. So this was the step. What we've been doing up to now is a step of going from a graph, known graph, to constraints. For discovery, we want to do the opposite, go from constraints back to the graph. But there's a problem there, which is that although we know what to do when we divide by a variable given its parents, what about if we divided by something that wasn't a variable given its parents? Because when we're running this discovery algorithm, we're not in the position where we know what the true graph is. We're just randomly flailing around dividing by bizarre densities, right? This is part of Jamie's intuition for sort of going after this, which is that we would think that these conditional independences after one step of reweighting might be very informative. So the reason for thinking that is, if I just give you an ordinary conditional independence, right, that's a relation on three sets, Z1, Z2, and Z3. Z1 and Z2 are symmetric. So, you know, there's structure in those conditional independences. But when we think about the simplest constraint after reweighting, we've now got five sets in play. Okay, we divided by X, Z4 given X, Z5. So those are two sets. And then we've got our conditional independence in the new distribution, which is another three sets. So there's much more possibility for asymmetry in the relations, much more structure. So that might allow us to narrow down our class of graphs much more if we're ever lucky enough to get one of these. So potentially very informative if we ever find one of these. But the problem is, as I said, we need to worry about the fact that we might divide by the wrong thing. We might be dividing by something that isn't a variable given its parents. And we need to have a theory that tells us that what happens if we divide by the wrong thing. So we know what happens if we divide by the right thing, i.e. a variable given its parents. But supposing we divide by the wrong thing, we didn't have any theory to say what would happen under those circumstances. Okay? So I think I can make an analogy here for people that are, so correct me if I'm wrong, but for people that are familiar with marginal structural models, the similar question would be, if I've got a marginal structural model and I just divide by the wrong density, what's going to happen as a consequence of that? So that's a, okay, and so I call this a shock. So this is the thing I worry about, which is I worry about the fact that we might get one of these constraints from a graph where it didn't have a simple causal interpretation, where we weren't just cutting a variable given its parents. And I did, after some sort of struggle, I was able to come up with examples that showed this can happen. So for example, if we look at this graph, if I divide by A given B1, B2, and B3, then I then end up, after I do that, I get to a new distribution in which X is independent of Y. And there's no way that you can sort of immediately see that from this graph, because B1, B2, and B3 are not the parents of A. So we need, so this is something which isn't covered by the existing theory, and this is the reason why that and chronic procrastination is the reason why it's taken us 10 years to get to this point, basically. I don't really, maybe not. Maybe it's recursion, not procrastination. But anyway, so we need to have a way to think about these non-Markovian constraints that's divorced from any causal interpretation. That's what I'm going to give you. So the basic idea is, you're going to come to me with a joint distribution coming from some graph, and then I'm going to just divide by an arbitrary density of A given B, and I'm going to generate for you a new graph that describes the Markov structure of that new distribution. So here's a very simple example. So think about this. This is just a Markov chain, x1, x2, x3, x4. Right? And now I'm going to divide by x4 given x1. Right? x4 given x1, which is not a legitimate move. x4 and x1 are dependent, because there's this pathway, but x1 is not the parent of x4 in this graph. So it's an illegitimate move. I mean, or at least it's a move not covered by the simple cutting edges when I condition on a variable given its parents. So instead, what I do is I'm going to embed this, I'm going to form a supermodel of this. So I'm going to form a graph that represents a subset of the independencies, so a superset of the distributions. And it turns out that what I need to do is to use something called a chain graph. Okay, so this is the part where there's a little bit more magic involved. So these chain graphs are things that sort of were introduced in the 1980s, I think, and part of the genesis was that Nanny Vermouth was working on directed graphs, and Stefan Lauritsen was working on undirected graphs, and then they wanted to write papers together, so they wanted to have a class of graphs that sort of covered both, and they came up with chain graphs as one way to do that. But anyway, so it turns out that chain graphs are what we need for this particular purpose. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to say, well, if this is true, if this model is true, if that represents the joint distribution, well, then this is a supermodel, so this is also true. And then in this particular model, now, it turns out the factorization associated with this chain graph has x4 given x1 as a term in it. So therefore, when I do that division, all I do is just remove that edge. Okay. You might be thinking, well, couldn't I have done it with a DAG? If I had done it with a DAG, I would have ended up... I could have done the same operation and gone to a DAG here, but in that case, I would have ended up with a graph that didn't capture all of the independencies that hold in the transform distribution. Okay, so that's the basic idea. And in some sense, I think I'm very close to going to stop the talk at this point. I'm going to show you one more example, basically. But this is the basic idea. The idea is you start off with a DAG, you then divide by A given B, and you want to come up with a new graph that represents the Markov structure after that operation. And we do that by going to this larger class of graphs. We have x4 given x1, and then we get to this. So I'll show you one. There's a general algorithm that can do this. I'm not going to go through all the details of it because it's assuming familiarity with chain graphs, which I'm kind of guessing is not kind of common knowledge here. I don't mean to presume, but I kind of that's my prior. So if you want to inform that, and say no, but of course, you know. Lawrence and Vermouth, 1988, then, you know, we can talk afterwards. So the basic idea, as I said, we embed into a larger thing where we have A and parents B star, and then we just remove those edges. So I'll just show you one more example to give you a flavor for how these things are operating. So here's another DAG, x1, x2, b1, b2, b3, b4. And now I'm going to divide by A given b1, b2, b3, b4. Again, bizarre thing to do. If you knew what the graph was, you wouldn't be doing this because, you know, b1, b2, b3, b4 are not the parents of A here. So it's a very strange operation to do. I mean, dividing by x given the parents of x is strange enough, right? That's already not standard conditioning. That's the G computation formula or, I don't know, various other references you can fill in. So that's bizarre enough. This is one step further bizarre. So let's see what happens when we do the transformation. So the first thing, basically our graph, the graph that we get has two pieces. Sort of one piece that comes before our intervention and one piece that comes after our intervention. And so the graph that we end up with in this particular setting looks like this. This is the graph that, so it has an undirected edge here, and then it has these directed edges. And another strange thing that happens is that we get hidden variables introduced during the operation. So if we go back to, so just to show you this operating on this example, this was Jamie's graph. Then if we divide by x1 given x0, that's easy enough. We just go to this. And in the way I described it to you before, I then did this step of marginalizing it over x0 that got x0 out of the picture and then meant that the parents of x3 after we got rid of x0, and actually we got rid of x0 and u4 and u1 and u2, at that point the parents of x3 were just x2 and x1, which was needed for Jamie's second division. But here we're not going to do that. We're just going to keep the graph here because our new theory allows us to divide by things when we're not dividing by all the parents. So we get to this graph. We get to this graph. This is the transform graph that shows up. And we can look at this graph, and if you're familiar with deseparation, you'll see x1 is independent, marginally independent of x4, because on any path from x1 to x4, there's a collider. Because if we go this way, if we go this way, then x2 is a collider. If we go this way, x2 is a collider. Go this way, x2 is a collider. Go this way, u4 is a collider. Go this way, x0 is a collider. Basically, there's a collider that we hit somewhere. So if we don't condition on anything, then we have Meissel independence. So the claims about discovery are kind of, this is even more provisional, but basically, the sort of the idea that we're going to have is now, conceptually, that we're going to assume that any observed independences in the distributions, including reweighted distributions, follow from the Markov structure of the corresponding graphs. And we're going to construct this sequence of graphs, G, and then our star graphs, and the double star graphs, and triple star graphs, and so on. And then, basically, we're going to try to recover what the underlying true graph is. So sort of the picture is the following. That I've got a DAG with observed variables and latent variables, and then, you know, we're going to divide by something like x1 given x0, which then transforms us to a new graph, and then we're going to divide by x3 given x1 and x2, and that gets us to yet another graph, and then we observe some independence down here, then using that independence we solve the inverse problem back here, and then we solve another inverse problem back here, and then we solve another inverse problem back there. So it's this is... There are some details that we're still working on here. So after doing going to the P double star distribution, if we ran the FCI algorithm, we would get this graph back. This is the graph that we would get back, assuming we got all the correct independence tests, gave us the right results. And then based on that, we can then say, well, how did I get to this P double star? Well, I just divided by x3 given x2 and x1. And so sort of using that information, we can then infer a little bit more of the structure of the graph before we did our division. And then again, we then say, well, how did we get to this distribution? We got this distribution by dividing by P of x1 given x0. So again, we can sort of use that fact to get back to the original graph that we had in this particular case. And this is, assuming that everything's right, this is the unique graph in this particular equivalence class. So it's a nice example. I'm using bidirected edges to imply that there might be a hidden variable up there. So yeah, so there's so we have a lot of things to do. We have to prove completeness for our Markov property. We have to develop an algorithm for exploiting this. We have to prove completeness. We have to perhaps develop it. This is a thing I put in. There, you know, people have been very happy about axiomatic approaches to conditional independence, so maybe we need an axiomatic approach to reweighted independence, and then we need to prove that. So there's a conjecture. There's a conjecture that basically, although there are shucks, although there are examples where you can get these constraints and they're not causally interpretable, if you do enough sort of clever moves and slightly change the graph and, you know, embed things, then you will get into a situation where it is causally interpretable. So this is a sort of, this is an ongoing conjecture war between me and Jamie and Ilya that I mean, I have this intuition too, but just, you know, intuitions are great, but definitions are greater, basically. That would be my... So that's it. Stop.
So for the algorithm, is there some reason why, so you have the original graph, and then you change it, you don't get anything, and then you change that graph, as opposed to then going back to the original graph and changing something else?
So you could do that as well. So this is why the algorithm is truly heroic, basically. I mean, Jamie was trying to convey that, but I mean, this is truly heroic when we go back to the original thing. So if we were doing it for discovery, so go back to here. So we start off, we find no independences. Okay? We then divide by, you know, every possible conditional density we could think of one thing given another. So we generate all of those possible distributions. We then run the... Yes, absolutely. We did that, and then for all of those, we then do a second thing. So this was why there was some very rapid factorial.
Make the point that you again, by just chance, first divided by epsilon x zero, instead of going through all the Star Wars, then I'll go immediately through Star Wars, and by chance you divided by x three given x two x one. At that moment, you could stop the algorithm because you'd be able to already recognize it.
I don't think there are genetic algorithms. I think that would be basically I don't know what the right word would be. It would be miraculous. Miraculous.
First living creature was a human.
So given that it's so hard to find this exact thing, could you just tell me how you got it?
So some of this is, so how did we come up with the example?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, Jamie basically came up with the example. But I mean, so to some degree, there's the fact, so this example, where is it? This is the Verma constraint. This is the Verma example. So Verma, in his paper, said, so there was this question, sort of, okay, I've got model with hidden variables. So here, U3 is hidden. I've got, so the red things were all hidden. I should have said that, but this is hidden. And then the question is, well, are there constraints that are arising that aren't conditional independence constraints? And Verma showed, yes, that's the case, for example, if you were to, so in this distribution, you can, he didn't think about it in this way, but he showed that there was a function. Actually, so let me see if I can do this. So basically, he showed.
There's always things, because we know you can estimate, there's no unmeasured confounding. You can use the computation algorithm on the observed data. X1 is not a direct cause.
Wait, what do you mean there's no confounding? What about
U3? There's no unmet, none, but because you can control it. There's no unmeasured confounding. If you just do the G computation algorithm on the observed data, do it your way.
Okay, so I mean, okay.
I'm confused, but what's the observed data? Is U3?
No.
U3 is not observed. Joint effect of X1 and X3 is identifiable.
So I hope I'm remembering this correctly. Correct me if I'm wrong. Of X3 alone. Okay. So I can. So this is the thing that. This is the thing that. If we have the true distributions here and we compute this thing and then we integrate over X2, sum out over X2, we then end up with something that you might expect to be a function of x4, x1, and x2. Sorry, x4, x1, and x3, but it's only a function of x1 from this particular graph. So this was the thing that Verma came up with. It was called a Verma constraint. So that one we knew about. That had been, I mean, that was 1992, people referred to that. And then basically, this is just embedding that in and saying, well, wait a second, I can kind of play this game recursively. So part of the purpose of doing it with a double star was just to show that there were times when you really need to do two steps, basically, and that the steps don't commute. So if I first try dividing by x3, given x2 and x1, and then doing the second one, I would get the wrong answer.
But the motivation, go back to the Verma. But the motivation I had, or hope.
Yeah, so Jamie had a different
motivation. Crazy algebraic expressions, which I recognized as just the G-computation algorithm, my world. All that said is that x1's on that graph, x1's not a cause of x4. I'm looking at the joint effect. Consider x4, the counterfactual, the effect of x1, x3 on x4, not x2. You can see that x1 can't get to x4 through the brain. But even if it could, I can estimate, yeah, dx4, do x1, do x4. Is
identical. Sorry, do x3.
You can see
sorry.
The breadth of sequential three. Randomized crime. X3. The two treatments, x1 and x3, have no unmeasured confounders at the points reflect.
Yeah.
Okay. But they had this tetrad program, and it was giving nothing. There was no conditional effect. But as soon as I understood the Markov structural models, where I said, I can use tetrad. First, go to a world where I've randomized x3 as well. That's what marginal structural models do. F of x3, given x2 and x1, I'm now in that world, and I have independence. So I said, tetrad's fine if you first divide. Should be able to use tetrad to do this, but I didn't understand tetrad. I just realized in this one case, I went to Thomas and said, let's start dividing and keep using tetrad.
So just going back to Jamie's point about the randomized trial, so this is like the max data, basically. You could think about x1 as being baseline. You could think about x1 as being first treatment, and then x2 is a response. And then x3 is the second treatment, and then x4 is the final outcome. And the key point basically is so this actually went back to the point you were saying and responding to earlier, right? That the problem is that if you just do this with conditional distributions, then if there's no direct effect of x1 on x4, at least so with binary things you can sort of fix it up. But if you have if some of these things are continuous, then in order for x1 to have so this is the situation. The way I describe it is. So this is your first treatment, then you get a side effect. Because of the side effect, the doctors take pity on you and give you a second treatment. The second treatment is actually good for the thing that the first treatment was originally designed to do. Okay? And if you were one of the patients, you would say, wait a minute, let's forget all that stuff about you giving me the lousy drug that then made me really sick, that then led you to actually bother to give me a proper treatment that then helped me out with the thing that you originally gave me the lousy treatment for. Let's cut out the stuff where you give me the lousy treatment and just give me the good treatment. Yeah, and so part of the problem is if you're trying to work out that, which you obviously need to know for optimal treatment, you have this problem that it's very hard to parameterize this. In fact, Jamie has theorems about if you use...
Your models, if there was a, make X2, like, what I do in this paper, binary, but make X1 continuous. So you've got to find me a distribution when you sum over a binary. Both pieces, X depend on X1, but that sum doesn't. Try to find yourself some parametric model to do that. And there are Cox and Furman found something. With just a regression of X2 and X1, let's say X4 was continuous, and linear regression of X4, X3, X2, X1, there's no way, notice on the graph, that X1 does predict X2, P of x2, x1 is dependent on x1. Notice on the graph that given x3 and x2, x1 predicts x4. You can do that by deconnection.
Because basically, this is a deconnecting path conditional on these two. This is
now
a deconnecting
path.
You have
to make these miraculous parametric distributions, so when you sum, you know each piece is, the sum isn't, while the sample space of x1 is uncountable. For an uncountable number of values of x1, to given x1 and linear to that, no matter how many interactions.
Anyway.
The marginal structural model, no problem.
Just dividing.
The hypothesis in the marginal structural model is that there's no to do x1 term.
So I'm going to carry on the spirit of this conference and just take over as the session chair now and say thank you very much for coming. And